You are listening to the Kelly Confidential podcast with Kelly Wilkes. This is episode 5. Welcome to the Kelly Confidential show, where we talk negotiation essentials and those crucial conversations empowering extraordinary women. Real women, real issues. Let's jump in. Hey there, lovely people. I hope you're having a great week. As I was producing this week's episode, Negotiating Salaries, it got me thinking about earnings potential and especially value potential. And I couldn't help but think about others who came before us to shrewdly haggle over the value of their output. And it made me think about entertainers, writers, and sports celebrities. And that brought me to the great Mark McCormick, founder of IMG. If you haven't heard of Mark McCormick, you should. Considered one of the greatest influencers of the 20th century, Mark single-handedly came up with the concept of the golden triangle of sport, sponsorship, and television. His career started out managing up-and-coming athletes in golf. He chose a then little-known golfer named Arnold Palmer, whom he signed in 1960, taking Palmer's annual income from $50,000 a year to well over $10 million a year at the peak of their relationship. So successful was he with Palmer that he went on to sign other young players like Gary Player and Jack Nicklaus, making the young golfers household names and millionaires. McCormick had a single-minded eye for scouting talent and understanding the value of their output when combined with sponsorship. But he never forgot who his clients were. It would have been easy for him to turn his back on the young athletes and go work as a marketing executive for the big brands. But what Mark saw was an opportunity for all parties to win, and win big, by combining their collective offerings together. Before big glitzy TV ads existed, Arnold Palmer's sponsors had him schlepping Heinz ketchup as a preferred sauce whenever he was in a restaurant. Fast forward 40 years with IMG, and Nike and Adidas have built their entire fortunes on such partnerships, all born out of a single vision for what could be. Named the most powerful man in sports by Sports Illustrated, McCormick's negotiation style and relationship-based leadership created untold sponsorship wealth for the likes of Arnold Palmer, Jack Nicklaus, Greg Norman, Monica Seles, Andre Agassi, Pete Sampras, Chris Everett, Jean-Claude Killy, Michael Schumacher, Charles Barkley, and the celebrated Venus and Serena Williams. There are many, many other incredible feats I can share with you about what McCormick and IMG achieved in their 40-year run, but that would be lazy. You really need to read about this master negotiator. Sadly, he died from a fatal heart attack at the age of 72, and his company was then sold on. But his book, What They Don't Teach You at Harvard Business School, is a masterclass in street smarts, vision, tenacity, and person-centered deal-making. His children posthumously honored his work and with another book called Beyond Harvard, which is another must-read for any negotiator. Both have guided me for several years, and they've been worth every cent. I hope you enjoy this episode. I leave you with one of Mark's famous quotes to inspire you. He said, "If you aren't afraid to fail, you probably don't care enough about success." Enjoy. Hey, so it's that special time of year. No, not Christmas, bonus season. The time when companies start to pay out bonuses, which is great, isn't it? I remember those days when I wasn't working for myself and I would eagerly await news of the company performance so I could see what I was going to get in my March payslip. And oftentimes it was spent well before I had it. My sister was definitely the saver between us, but yeah, I typically had plans for that bonus. I think with my first bonus, I bought my very first new car, like in brand new from the dealership.
as I'd had used cars up till then. I think I was about 20 and working, and I got my first bonus. And yeah, I put all of it toward a red Suzuki Swift hatchback. I loved that car. You would have thought I'd won the lottery for how chuffed I was. Anyway, I digress. So there's another big event that is typical of this time of year, which is most times inextricably linked to the bonus season. And that's the annual exodus of staff who, dissatisfied or disillusioned or simply ambitious for change, decide shortly after receiving the company bonus to leave their job and go elsewhere. To be fair, most people start thinking about resigning long before March. It's often solidified around the start of the new year and is often hinged to either expectations of salary increases or bonuses or general unhappiness. I think the Huffington Post wrote that the 13th of January marked National Quitters Day. No, it's really a thing. You can Google it. And for most people, money is the main motivator to switch jobs. And according to a January 2023 study that indicated that 35% of employed staff will start to job hunt at the very first whiff of possible letdown in bonus payouts, and 20% will actually act on that and just quit. So what about the folks that decide to stick it out? They get their bonus, but what else happens this time of year for permanent staff? That's right, performance reviews. And it's this time of year or thereabouts when managers and staff start to look at an individual's performance against the upcoming needs of the company. And that usually results in either more responsibility and the potential for increased earnings, or the same responsibilities and therefore no increase or a tiny inflationary increase under the terms of their contract. So what do all of these events have in common? Well, unless you've won the lottery, you're going to need a salary for the foreseeable future. And so it's this time of year that many will negotiate the one area that gives them great anxiety every time. You guessed it, it's salary. Well, you're not alone, and it doesn't need to be as painful as you imagine. It's actually easier than you think. So let's jump in. Today, I'm going to provide three micro lessons on how to negotiate your pay packet. The first will be how to negotiate your salary for a new job, new company. The second will be negotiating an increase for an existing role. And the third will be negotiating either of these, but via email. So let's start with lesson one, negotiating salary for that new job. First things first, I want to say well done for making the hard decision to move and make this change. Sometimes the harder issue isn't haggling the new deal, it's actually reaching and executing on the decision to leave the old deal, your old employer in this case. For many people who have been in the same company for years, and for certain cultures and age groups, this is not uncommon. You will find it incredibly difficult to leave. Deciding is the easy part, actually. It's the execution of the idea that's so tough. It's the telling your boss, perhaps telling your loyal team. It's saying the goodbyes and packing up your memories, handing in your badge, and coming to the end of what may have been a major chapter in your life. So none of this is taken lightly. But before you hand in your badge, you've got to have another job lined up, right? Right. So you've done all the grafting, you nailed the interviews, you passed the background checks, you've sussed the journey time to the new office. You just need the offer to sign contracts. So they call you up, as they would typically do. Although since COVID, I know some places make their first offer an email, which is actually poor form, I think, and a bit lazy on the part of the HR person. But that's a different episode for another day. So for argument's sake, let's say they call you up and make the offer. Here begins my top five rules for negotiating your new salary and pay package. Number one, know the market, know your competition and what that role in that company is paying, and likewise know what other companies are paying, i.e. for the same or similar job. There are a number of job boards that can help you with benchmarking stats for similar roles and compensation. And in terms of the competition, always ask the recruiter or the hiring manager, how many candidates are being considered? Where do you rank me amongst those candidates? And are there any deficiencies on paper that I can help to clarify for you? And if you find you're too afraid to ask these questions, you may not be ready for this job. And on top of that, you need to know what your new boss wants. And better to ask these questions in a job interview. You're both people at the end of the day, so before you can hope to influence a decision in your favor, you need to firstly understand her and what she needs from you. And really, before you even get into the interview, you should be asking the recruiter what your future boss is looking for in an ideal candidate. You don't need permission to ask these questions, so don't be a wallflower. Just trust in yourself and get in there and ask. And then when you do make it to the interview, you should have two key things: a pen and a notebook with your questions in it. I can't express enough what a turnoff it is as a hiring manager to go into an interview with a candidate who shows up with literally nothing but themselves for the interview. No notebook, nothing to write with, and I instantly know that it's a no before we even get started. Why? Because despite how smart or qualified the candidate may be, they didn't consider the role seriously enough to warrant 10 minutes to research my company, me, or the role to ask questions beyond the superficial. And anyone who thinks taking a notebook and pen to an interview is old school is likely working at the lower end of their earnings potential for a reason. So what questions to ask in an interview? Questions that very specifically seek from your future boss what traits she's looking for in the ideal candidate, what challenges they face this year, what critical programs you can help to deliver in the next quarter, and always, always ask for feedback at the end of the interview. So when you're thanking them for their time and for answering your questions, and on that, make sure you're being sensible, right? Don't ask a gazillion questions just to look curious. Be mindful and sensitive to their time and keep it short, sweet, and impactful. But when you're wrapping up, ask if there's anything else you could bring to the table. This is a great question to ask and packs a punch in its return because the hiring manager gains as she can see you're modest and brave enough to accept criticism, because trust me, sometimes they will lay it out. But it also gives you insights about areas you may need to work on if you in fact get the job. And you can use that as a talking point for your next year's performance bonus discussion when you demonstrate how you nailed that. It's a win-win. But back to the talking point. You're in the call with the offer on the table. It looks okay, but not where you want it to land. And so you want to counter. All of that research and all of those questions you asked will have informed you precisely what you are worth in relation to the role. If their offer is substandard, your knowledge of these facts will make it easier to start the counter process. Okay, and rule number two, be objective. This follows my earlier point about doing your homework. Not only does it prepare you for questions in the interview, as mentioned previously, it also pumps your brain full of useful facts and figures that will keep your greedy devil in check. It mitigates the temptation to be subjective, i.e. ask for a higher sum simply because the number sounds nicer in your head, and it arms you for a more fruitful negotiation. Why? Well, because an objective bargainer, coined a principled bargainer in their book Getting to Yes by Harvard negotiation experts Roger Fisher and William Ury, a principled bargainer who uses facts, references, and market information is less likely to experience willful debate and is more likely to get a favorable outcome. The counter of this is a subjective bargainer, known as a positional bargainer, one who asserts the merits of their case on the basis of opinion, will, and personal need. Really little explanation is needed to understand where those types of conversations end up. And so, closing this point about being objective, that rule likewise applies to understanding and processing the company's constraints, i.e. they may not be able to offer you the higher package you're seeking right now because they've perhaps gone through restructuring, but their 12-month business plan shows they will be in a position to increase hiring and incentives from year two. something you would have hopefully known about having done your research beforehand. In which case, there are other things you can negotiate instead of pay alone, like vacation time, future and more frequent bonuses, etc. So make sure you're considering the whole deal, not just your salary. Rule 3, be likable. While you're going through this hiring process, plan, prepare, and embrace the mindset that you will likely need to negotiate some matters. And above all, remember that this isn't personal. Start as you mean to continue. What do I mean by that? I mean that you should recognize your commitment to stewardship, i.e. making the company better through your contributions, in return for compensation. And that allows you to focus on the intent and not get defensive about the haggling process. And within that, be your natural, helpful, likable self. Remaining objective and being sincere and helpful altogether produce the package of likability. You will instantly endear yourself to that hiring manager and leave a mark. If you're skilled enough to sprinkle some humor in there, you're winning. But don't force humor if it's not natural to you, as that can also bomb badly. So just, you know, be yourself. Rule number 4, resist accepting the first offer. Why? Because unless it exceeds your salary and package expectations, which is unusual, your first emotion will be relief. Mainly because, remember, you really want to get out of your current job. So you'll be excited and the temptation is just too great to jump at the offer. So you should avoid this, taking comfort from the fact that most employers expect you to take it away. Discuss with your partner, for example, and come back to them. So use that time to take it away quietly, look at the whole offer to make sure it's what you want and what works for you and your family. And again, the research work you did in advance will pay dividends here, as at this point in the process, the pay range and packet should not come as a surprise. You should be well-versed in what you're worth and what the role is worth. Now it's a matter of closing any gap. And rule number 5, counter the offer. So you've done everything else right up to this point. You've received the verbal offer, thanked them for the information, reassured them that you're keen, and you put them on hold momentarily while you reviewed the details. So how long should that be and how do you counter? Well, a day or two tops really is the right duration. Any longer than that, and most recruiters will sniff out what they believe is that they're being used as a stalking horse for another offer. And this is a risky gamble, and it's not uncommon where a marginally unhappy employee will seek a new role solely for the aim of getting a better pay with their existing employer. I can't fault this strategy on paper, but nobody wants to feel second best. And hiring managers worth their salt will always have more than one candidate lined up as a solid plan B, so don't get cocky here. Anyway, leave it a day if you can. You have the edge in that precise moment because you've sold them the vision and they want to buy. You are their preferred candidate, so you need to act while the iron is hot. Taking too long can also make you look unprepared. So within a day, typically you should go back to them with a yes or a counter. If countering, be brave and call them first. Don't email the counter, that can show weakness. Thank the recruiter again and say something like, "Thanks, Diane. I really appreciate the time that you and Jane put into this selection process. I love what Spring is doing in the market. Your fall 2022 campaign was brilliant, and I know I can bring the right level of experience and skill to the team to help you reach your 20% growth target. I'm happy with the bonus and benefits arrangement, and I need a salary of X in order to accept today, which I'm prepared to do if we can get to that right figure, and that would enable me to serve my notice on my current employer." This example is open and direct, and the term right figure shows Diane that you're open to alternatives, just not as low as their first number. What else can you do to close the gap? You can look to stagger a bonus incentive later in the first year with a promise of a fixed salary change in year two, or an immediate signing bonus. Or look at other areas like tuition assistance if you want to work on an MBA, for example, or extra vacation time is a popular tradable. Okay, so on to lesson 2, negotiating an increase to your existing salary. So I want you to keep in mind all the good practices I just shared in lesson one, but now do these things additionally. Number one, know the market and specifically how your company fits into that market, i.e. is your company performing well? Is it known for fair pay or generous pay? Does it have good NPS scores? And do people really like working there? If it's a yes to all of those, you need to know that there are probably a few people that would fight to take your job. So don't get cocky in this process, because that greedy devil friend I mentioned earlier could really backfire on you if your boss thinks your heart isn't in the role and you're really only there for the money. And rule number two, again, know your boss and what he, she wants from you now and in the future. Annual reviews and quarterly performance checkpoints should tell you if you're on track with her expectations. You should know your boss's business and team goals as well as you know your own. And number three, be your value. If you want to be worth more, then be worth more. So many people expect a raise or a bonus as a de facto standard. Simon Sinek, in his lecture series last week, shared insights from a study where large swathes of young people were prepared to quit if they didn't get a raise on demand. It was actually a really funny talk, and I've left the link in the show notes together with a link to his brilliant book, Start With Why. But yes, if you want your employer to pay you more, you need to earn it and be worth more. So my rule, be good at your job. Preempt the next need. That means think ahead and be proactive, and over-deliver. Those things done consistently will raise your worth in any organization. And if you provide that level of internal customer service time and again, reliably, with your other key stakeholders or key clients, then guess what? You've just made yourself invaluable. And rule four, plant the seed with your boss that you believe you're underpaid in contrast to your duties. How? Ask for a meeting at least a month or two before you want this resolved. This undercompensation scenario won't have just occurred overnight. Most times your job becomes the victim of scope creep, or you've been moved onto a huge new project or double client rosters, and you realize you're working a heck of a lot harder, but your compensation hasn't kept up. So you need to set up a meeting, and in the subject line, just write my performance. That alone will focus minds as to what you want to talk about. Then once you're in the meeting, you need to share that you really enjoy what you're doing, you're glad that they've trusted you with this new campaign, and you feel that it fits well with your skills and experience, but that you recognize the compensation hasn't changed and that you'd like to address that in this quarter, this fiscal year, for example. Be confident, be direct, be polite. This works. If you like my show and want to hear more of these topics, please give me a like and follow us. And please join my mail list to find out about upcoming courses, which will be heading your way this spring. Go to kellyconfidential.com and subscribe to our newsletter. And finally, lesson three, negotiating salaries, or really any substantial money issues, over email. So I'm going to hit you with some detail here, but I do it out of love because seriously, you should avoid negotiating your salary over email. And here's the number one reason why. Miscommunication. Yep, that's right. Above all else, miscommunication is top of the charts for the primary reason to avoid negotiation and conflict resolution via email. Let's break it down. Words are the smallest factor in how we communicate. A 1967 study completed by research scientist Albert Mehrabian and his colleagues found that only 7% of what we communicate is through the actual words. 55% is communicated through body language, and the rest, 38%, is through tone of voice. So what does this mean in practice? Well, the study was trying to convey that the greatest significance in communication, i.e. the point we're trying to make, came through and was firstly registered with the other party via body language and then tone in that order, with the actual words coming up last. Dr. Jeff Thompson, a research scientist at Columbia University, likewise suggests using the three C's to better gauge a person's frame of mind so as to avoid miscommunication. These are context, congruence, and clusters. And I agree with him, and I actually teach these points on my course, which is don't hang your hat on the first statement or roll of the eyes. As individual messages, these signs don't really mean anything, so you need to take them in context of the message and frequency of the same message, body language, gesture, or tone. Observe it if it is part of a pattern, and then apply what the pattern is telling you, i.e. if someone crosses their arms once in a meeting, are they angry or simply cold? On its own, it's not enough to draw a conclusion, but if nobody else is doing it, and the room isn't cold, and your colleague continually crosses and uncrosses their arms, this is seen as a defensive position, which is a message worth processing. Are you still not sure? Well, according to clinical psychologist and author, Dr. Randy Gunther, we risk miscommunicating with one another if we fail to use any one of these five modes of communication: words, tone, touch, posture, and facial expressions. Scowl when speaking, well, something is, you know, definitely amiss. The same principles are 100% true in an email negotiation. And by removing the window to both tone and body language, you're basically a one-wheeled race car quickly approaching a hairpin turn. You just wouldn't do it. The potential for miscommunication about money issues is so high and possibly irrecoverable. Is that something really worth risking because you couldn't get to a phone? But don't take my word alone. Research by Harvard Business School estimated that nearly 50% of negotiations done by email ended in deadlock or outright failure, which is painful. Painful. And if the recruiter starts the salary offer process in email, which sometimes happens, that doesn't mean you follow it. On the contrary, your desire to take it out of email and into live dialogue speaks volumes of your character and desire for this job. And so that's it, my friends. You've made it. Today we've covered how to negotiate a new job salary, how to negotiate an existing job salary, and how to handle email negotiations. I hope this was useful. If so, please make sure to leave us a like and follow us so you can receive notices when the next episode drops. Check out our show notes for some of the mentioned resources. I wish you great success in your job hunt, and we'll see you next time.